This is the SCLO Library Podcast. In this episode, we are diving into Chinese art history and techniques. This is in advance of a SCLO Labs event about Chinese art on April 24th, 2021. In that event, Chinese art educator Ashley Yang Liu will present the class on Chinese art, and you can even paint along if you like. We'll be talking to Ashley later in this episode, but first we will learn about contemporary Chinese art and how it evolved out of the legacy of a communist past with Dr. Cheng Tan from Penn State. Thanks for coming along as we dive into the rich history of Chinese art. Dr. Tan is an assistant professor of art history and Asian studies at Penn State University, specializing in Chinese and East Asian art in the 20th and 21st century. Having been published in Art Journal, World Art, and Third Text, among others, she has recently finished a book examining contemporary Chinese artists encountering with the public. Dr. Tan, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ben.
I think that when most Americans picture Chinese art, they picture traditional ink landscapes with an effective and characteristic use of negative space. But what is the story of Chinese art in the 20th and 21st century?
So I would say this picture Americans have for traditional Chinese art, it's not necessarily inaccurate, but it's partial, right? Obviously, there were all kinds of art produced in these centuries before the 20th century. But okay, to answer your question, there's a lot that happened in the 20th and 21st century, but I guess the most important story is that Chinese art, as the rest of society, went through this rapid and rather radical process of modernization. And so basically, in the 20th century, most of the Chinese artists were more engaged with and trained in the medium of oil painting in a typical sort of European academic manner instead of the traditional Chinese manner. And realism became the sort of predominating theme. Okay, and so there was this very intense pursuit to represent, you know, the actual visible world as closely as possible in a way that is comparable to the Renaissance artists. And that's one trend of this development. But the other trend is obviously they did not just want to be an imitator of, you know, European art. So there was this very strong desire to combine the best from the West and what they had in China. So there were basically two types of innovations. One is to use oil to paint some of the traditional themes, like, you know, landscape or horses or whatnot, and use both the motifs and the techniques from ink paintings in oil paintings, and also vice versa, right? To use ink to actually do sketch, do like historical paintings, to produce complex compositions. So it's like, you know, this effort to combine the best of the two and create something that is both expressive and realistic. So that's kind of another trend going on. So there are like two things to summarize. Yeah.
What effect did the Communist Party have on the development and direction of Chinese art? And what are some of the aesthetic legacies that current Chinese artists have inherited or operate under?
So, well, that basically started after 1949. And one thing that did not change was this very high level of realism, you know. So, and when you say realism, it's always like you have to pause a little bit, right? So it's, what do you mean? It's not, realism is really never a photographic representation of reality. There's always, you want to kind of project some of the ideas into it, right? So in the Mao period, in the communist period, which I would say 1949 to 1978, something like that, the dominant style is something that people later call romanticist realism. So you paint vivid human figures in a somewhat believable setting, doing impossibly heroic things, right? So you're like removing the mountains, you're fighting the enemy with gigantic fists, you know, and you're replacing the old with the new. And obviously there were numerous portrayals of Mao Zedong and all these communist leaders in a kind of religious cult-like manner. So you use these realistic techniques to really kind of portray these romantic views of revolution. So that's really what the art in this era was about.
Okay. And that lasted up into 79, or I guess the end of the Cultural Revolution?
Yeah. Mao Zedong died in 1976. And in a couple of years, like the regime changed radically. So then they kind of opened up, you know, to the rest of the world.
Was that reflected in the art of the period that came after?
Yeah. It changed like pretty quickly in a matter of, you know, a few years. In 1980s, the biggest trend in Chinese art was already the almost too enthusiastic embrace of modernism, like all the way from Impressionism, Cubism to the latest trend in the West, because they were kind of prevented from seeing this type of art for decades. So the artists just went nuts about this. And that's like a sort of 180 degree kind of, you know, turn of events. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Must have been an exciting time with everything flourishing.
Yeah, right. You know, I was just born at the time, so I did not experience this excitement. But when I read about this, it was just, you know, people were like, people in the art institutions, they would really rather buy or borrow books of Western art than, you know, using the money to eat, like to buy food. So it's like there were this incredible enthusiasm about Western avant-garde art in 1980s.
Okay. So what does Chinese art look like today?
Yeah, so, okay. Actually, so yeah, what you were asking earlier, I want to go back to that a little bit. So did the Mao era, this revolutionary era, you know, did that leave any imprint on the art after this revolutionary era was over? So I would say it does. You know, so one thing is that people are still using these kind of images from the revolutionary communist era. So you still have like one of the most well-known school of contemporary art. And by well-known, I mean like they sold the best in international auctions. They sold for millions of dollars, you know. And this type of art, they were called like a political pop. So what does that look like? And you can Google it, political pop, and you would see basically you have images of Mao or the Red Guards or the revolutionary heroes painted in a bombastic manner next to commercial icons like Coca-Cola or it's like Andy Warhol-ish type of, you know, you're making fun of these, both of these cultures. Okay, so this is one legacy you can still see in the sort of art produced in China today. They're kind of comparing the communist culture with capitalist culture or the commercial culture, and you see both of them could be pretty ridiculous in certain ways. So, and the other thing is that that has to do with the actual society of China today, which is still nominally communist, right? The party is still called Communist Party, but really the Chinese society is more commercialized than anything I've ever seen. Okay, so it's like you go to any place in China today, it feels like the level of commercialism is like Disneyland here or Vegas. You know, it's kind of, you're surrounded by all these commercial images and people trying to sell your stuff. And so there was, in this kind of atmosphere, there is this sense of nostalgia, maybe like the, you know, the time of the revolution when people were living simpler and had very little material desires, and they were working close with each other, has a stronger sense of community instead of competing with each other ferociously. So there's this sense of nostalgia as well. So there are these, there's another trend of Chinese art today, which is try to be more communal, more collective, more connected with the public or the past. So I would say both of these trends have something to do with the Mao era, you know, so it's like, but in a very different way. So yeah, but that's a, you know, part of the story. Yeah.
In looking at modern Chinese art, what can we tell about China's sense of space and or identity?
Right. So I think that's something you have brought up about, if you think about this typical, stereotypical traditional Chinese art, it's like this overwhelming, monumental, gigantic nature with a lot of negative space in which human beings are tiny, right? So that's like, so that is certainly has its own conception of space. So which probably reflected people's human beings' ideas about their own existence at the time, right? Because in pre-modern times, like humans were fragile compared with nature.
Right.
Okay. So, and that did change, especially during the revolutionary communist era, because then the idea was that humans could conquer nature and just, you know, do whatever they want with it and order the nature to do the things they want. So that's, so there is this change. Like if you look at the kind of landscape paintings produced in a modern era, you can see that human figures often loom much larger in nature, or they were doing some things that were changing nature for industry, you know? So there is this very strong sense, you know, change, sense of change. And also you used some images like of how, what people were surrounding the revolutionary leaders. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course you have a lot of that as well. So yeah. And also, but that's another change, like in traditional Chinese paintings, of course you had a lot of paintings of elites, of emperors, of, you know, these people, but in the traditional paintings, those elites were often isolated, right? They were just sitting on the throne. They were in the palace. They were on their own. There's no one near them, right? So, yeah. And that's probably how they actually lived. Okay. But in modern times, I think there was this ideal that a real leader should be surrounded by the humble everyday people. And that was actually, that did not really happen in reality, but that was what's being portrayed in pictures, that they were part of the people. Yeah.
I guess in your two examples, both are conceptions of the state, right?
Mm-hmm.
One is hierarchical with mm-hmm. the divine king above, and mm-hmm. the other is the first citizen, but one of many, right?
So. Yeah, that's exactly. And I think that's, I don't know if I see a parallel in, like, for example, you know, Euro-American paintings, but.
Yeah, just thinking about in classical painting is so influenced by Christianity. I think there's often the halo or someone's divine right to rule is signified through Christian symbols.
European kings were, European emperors or kings in general, they were much more fond of their own portraits than Chinese emperors. They see a lot more portraits of European kings and Chinese emperors, with a few exceptions, I would say.
Okay, that surprises me. So painting wasn't used as a symbol of the state to kind of reaffirm its authority, which is what I would see Europeans having done.
Right, yeah. Right, exactly. That's actually very interesting kind of, it's a real difference. So like a lot of these art created in the European context were public art. You know, you had these gigantic statues, like people sitting on horses and palaces and murals, like paintings in churches that were out there for the general public to admire, right? So that's how they kind of asserted their authority or divine rights to rule. But in China, actually, the emperor, you would never see a public representation of the emperor in the broader public. And that would actually be considered sacrilegious. Huh. That is, no, the emperor is so divine and so remote from the everyday people, he cannot even be seen.
Okay.
So there's this different way of imagining power.
Yeah.
You know, so, and he would be reflected by some other things. Like he would be, you know, you would see dragons, you'd see these symbols of his power, but you would not see his actual face, which is a privilege not everyone can,
right,
can access. Yeah.
Interesting. Mm. Interesting. If you were going to give one picture and one book to an American to give an insightful look into China, what would you select?
Yeah, that's actually a great question, because I, you know, I've been, after you asked this question, then I thought about it, and the answer is actually pretty clear. I never thought about it, but it's, and for book, I would say it's books by Peter Hessler. He has written three books about China. He's a, you know, journalist, and he lived in China for many years, and he wrote three books. The first is River Town, and then it's a book called Oracle Bones. And then in 2010, he wrote his third book, I think it's Country Driving. Okay, so any of these three books, I guess, probably you can start with Country Driving because it's the closest. And then if you found it's interesting, you can go back. And he is a great writer, has a very excellent sense of humor. Like he's very good observing people's eccentricities, and you know, they're, all these characters he portrayed were both like intimate and relatable, but also somewhat weird. So you know, he's very good. He's a very good observer of any kind of characters, and he was very, he knew the language well. He, you know, had many friends there, and he always made these subtle comparisons between the two cultures in a way that I found like very authentic. You know, usually if you read a journalistic piece, you find the comparison rather crude or simplistic, but his ideas of how these two cultures would relate or differ from each other are really authentic and nuanced.
Yeah.
And it's very, very entertaining. And that's the other thing. He's very entertaining. He's a joy to write, to read. It's like a bedtime reading sort of thing. So I would recommend Peter Hessler's books.
Okay.
And for painting or artwork, I would not say painting, but artwork would, an interesting artwork would be Xu Bing's Square Calligraphy. So Xu Bing, and I will spell his name, it's X-U, Xu, and Bing, B-I-N-G, okay. And so Square Calligraphy, and he did a bunch of works, okay. He was, you know, living in China, and he moved to the U.S., and he lived in the U.S. for a long time, and then he moved back to China. And he, a lot of his artworks were about words, about writing. And he always kind of tried to navigate between two linguistic systems, you know, Chinese and English. So his Square Calligraphy was based on the idea that he could teach foreigners to write Chinese, to do calligraphy.
Okay.
And basically, if you look at these words that he created for Square Calligraphy, I mean, they look quite authentically Chinese at the first glance, but then you find out every word is actually English. Okay, it's kind of, he turned English letters in a way that looked like Chinese and put them together. So every character is actually an English word being reassembled.
Wow.
So, yeah, and he has been traveling around the world and actually teaching people, having classrooms where people could actually come in and wrote these words, like being taught by him.
Dr. Tan, thanks for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Again, it's my pleasure. And I, you know, happy to talk again when we can actually see each other in person.
Yeah, hopefully soon. Hopefully soon. Midpoint Break and most podcasts is underwritten by commercial interest. At Sklo Library, however, our only concern is nurturing a rich cultural life here in central Pennsylvania. To that end, all our underwriters are from fiction. Promotional consideration for this episode is provided by Gourmet Night at Faulty Towers, Torquay's premier hotel. Come feast on duck with orange, duck with cherries, or duck surprise. As always, no riffraff will be admitted. If you have an underwriter from fiction you would like to see sponsor the show, send your advertisement copy to podcast@sklolibrary.org. Here are two ways you can help make our community more sustainable and resilient to climate impacts. The first is to take local government sustainability survey by April 30th, 2021 for a chance to win a $100 gift card or other prizes. The second is to attend the virtual open public forum on addressing climate impacts in the Center region on Tuesday, April 13th, 2021 from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. To register or take the survey, visit centersustains.com, a link you can find in this episode's description. We are joined by Ashley Yang Yu, a Chinese art educator. Ashley has a really fascinating YouTube channel on how to paint in a traditional Chinese style and do calligraphy. There are links in this episode's description that I recommend, but you can also come to the Sklo Labs event on Chinese art on April 24th, 2021. Ashley, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much to be here to share something about Chinese painting with you, with everyone.
So what are some characteristics and aesthetics of Chinese art?
Brush strokes are a very important characteristics of Chinese art. We have a special type of painting called bai miao, means drawing an outline. We don't find this in Western countries. It is not a sketch exactly. For example, the artist paints a peony. He just paints the outline of the petals, but every stroke is varied. Lift the brush, press the brush, then lift the brush. Three consistent movements can get a perfect stroke. Also, there is something to which stroke comes first and which comes last. This puts the aesthetics in every piece. So another important characteristic is the use of white space in painting. This is rare in Western oil painting, for example. It derives from the philosophy of opposite in ancient China, think yin and yang, which in this case is reality and fiction. Paintings that have all of the space painted are missing this quality. So in Chinese painting, we consider what parts should be painted and what should be left empty.
So Chinese calligraphy doesn't really have an analog in the Western tradition. Can you explain its role in the Chinese tradition?
I really like this question. Actually, Chinese calligraphy and Chinese painting developed closely together. Chinese calligraphy plays an important role in Chinese tradition. In ancient China, we didn't have pens or pencils. We only had brushes. So when the artists wanted to write something, they had to use brushes. And the Chinese calligrapher's main tool is the brush. The best to do Chinese calligraphy every day. It is an art, a Chinese tradition, but also necessary for communication. And also Chinese calligraphy is developed into different scripts through the many dynasties. In modern times, our communication tools have changed. The brush by the pen and the pen by the keyboard. But we are still writing, so the artist aspect becomes more and more important if it is so survivor. Many modern people are still interested in Chinese calligraphy. I don't see it going away.
If folks wanted to learn more, what are some resources that you could direct them to?
My YouTube channel, Yang Travel Art, Yang, Y-A-N-G. Okay. My channel features classes on Chinese painting and calligraphy. Classes range from beginner friendly to intermediate. Some are English and some are in Mandarin, with base of Chinese culture and history mixed in.
If listeners want to find out more, they can follow the link in this episode's description. Are there any art activities listeners can do at home that are informed by Chinese art?
Yes, there is so much you can do between learning online and practicing on your own with your pod. If you are really motivated, you can connect me for private video lessons. YouTube is a great place to start. Then, depending on where you live and the COVID regulations, you can go to art galleries and that display Chinese art. This is great for inspiration and something I particularly enjoy.
So what have I not asked you that I should have?
So the first one would be, what's the best age to learn Chinese painting? So all of my students are different ages, from 6 to 80. So it's never too late to learn. If you can practice regularly for 1 month, you will see big improvements. Probably one more I want to add it, like, what's the benefit of learning Chinese art? So first, if you are interested in different countries' cultures, art is an interesting way to start. Chinese painting is very different from oil painting and even watercolor. So there are more brush techniques. For example, Chinese painting is easier than Chinese calligraphy.
So what book would you recommend that gives an insightful look into China?
There are some history books, but I think they are too boring, at least for me. I would recommend picture books that feature the beautiful ancient Chinese paintings. That's a good way to train the eyes and get a good taste. And also, many people are interested in actual Chinese food versus Westernized Chinese food. And for that, I recommended the Taste of China series, which has episodes that can be found for free on YouTube.
Okay, great. What's your favorite food?
Like a hot pot, dumplings.
Okay.
Yeah, there are so many.
So Ashley Yang Liu, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Our poetry nightcap is titled David by Felix Jung. We bow 3 times before his name, because tradition is stronger than death. I'm with my father, who's holding flowers wrapped in a thin gauze of paper. We stare at the dates on the marble, trying the math, a difference of years. In mausoleums, nothing marks the years passing, save only the new names that appear. Next to his grave, a marble slab waits for my grandmother. There, I see her birth, a hyphen, a space blank as paper. My father replaces the dried flowers from the vase. Our newer, brighter flowers have only begun their dying. 3 years ago, my father came here alone, and on paper wrote my grandfather's true name in Chinese letters. My body is stiff as a bow, arms by my side, eyes fixed on the marble. The Chinese words stand out against the marble's white skin. In the stems and thorns of the flowers, I see brush strokes. Delicate curves of black which I could never draw. I went to Chinese school for years and learned how to write my own true name, a handful of simple words scratched on paper. But my words never looked correct on paper, not like the books, not like the letters on the marble. I'm unable to read my grandfather's true name. We bow 3 times before departing, leave the flowers by the grave, and I wonder, how many more years will we have of this? Before a day comes when I will come alone. A part of me knows that I must practice writing, putting down on paper all those Chinese words I learned so many years ago. Against the shine of the white marble, I see my face reflected, the backs of the flowers, the thick black strokes that start my family's name. In the years to come, these are the things I will have to do. Pick a shade of marble, buy flowers, and on a piece of paper, write my father's true name. This podcast is produced by SCLO Center Region Library. Thanks to our guests for joining us. In this episode's description, you will find a whole heap of links to many of the things we talked about, including the Sklo Labs event on Chinese art that you should totally come to. I'm Ben Drain, your old friend and erstwhile companion. Take care until we meet again.